A very warm welcome to the Editor's Highlights podcast for the April 2024 edition of Practical Neurology, the essential guide for all neurologists. I'm Amy Ross-Russell. I'm a neurology trainee in Southampton and podcast editor for Practical Neurology. If you listen to the fantastic Editor's Highlights podcast for this edition, you'll already know what a treat you've got in store, both from this podcast, but also from our associated case-based podcasts with Martin Turner, Ruth Wood and Xinyu Tai, and of course from reading and digesting the paper journal itself. If you've not already discovered it, I would highly recommend the Cryptic Neurology Crossword, courtesy of Professor Matthew Walker, Dr. Umesh Vivekananda, and Dr. Lucy Kinton in the ABN News section. Today, I'm going to be discussing spontaneous intracranial hypertension with the team behind new guidelines from a UK-based specialist interest group. Professor Manjit Matharu, Dr. Indran Devanyanam, and Mr. Parag Sayal, all working together at the National Hospital of Neurology and Neurosurgery. And I'll let them introduce themselves now.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you for inviting us to this podcast. I am Professor Manjit Matharu. I'm a professor of neurology at University College London and an honorary consultant neurologist at the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery.
Hi, thanks Amy for inviting us. I'm Indran Devanyanam. I'm a consultant neuroradiologist at the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery and honorary associate professor at the Institute of Neurology.
Hi everyone, my name's Parag. I'm a consultant neurosurgeon at the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery, Queen Square. Complex spinal disorders, but with a specialist interest in spinal fluid leaks.
Thank you all. That's fantastic and really, really welcome. And thank you for giving up your time to discuss this review and this really important topic. Manjit, could we start with you? Just talk us through what spontaneous intracranial hypertension is and why it's a diagnosis that seems to be so difficult to make.
Okay, so starting with what is spontaneous intracranial hypertension? To a certain extent, what the syndrome is within the name itself. It is a syndrome in which there is low pressure, and even though it says it's intracranial hypertension, the reality is that the syndrome is in fact intraspinal. There is leakage of CSF from a spinal level, and of course there is some discussion about whether or not this is a pressure to do with this is a syndrome to do with low pressure or low volume. And it's often best thought of as a spontaneous syndrome where you have spinal CSF leak, which can lead in either low volume or a low pressure state. The leakage of the CSF can occur from either a dural tear. It can also occur from a leaking meningeal diverticulum. And what is new that's coming onto the scene now is the concept of CSF venous fistula. You can have a connection between the spinal subarachnoid space and the venous circulation, and that leakage of the CSF from the CSF space into the venous circulation can also lead to this syndrome. And this was an underappreciated and really newly described diagnosis. And these three etiologies are what really lead to this entity, spontaneous intracranial hypertension. Now, how common is it? The annual incidence of this is approximately 4 per 100,000. It tends to predominate in females by a factor of about 2-to-1 for female to male ratios. It is highly disabling. So on a recent study we did where we looked at the EuroQol visual analog scores, which really gives you a measure out of 100 about how impacted these patients are. These patients rated their quality of life at 35, which is amongst some of the lowest you have for neurological conditions across the board. About 25% of the patients lose their jobs, and another 50% only cope with significant amendments to their lifestyle, thereby emphasizing the importance of this picking up this syndrome about how disabling it is. And as you're pointing out, there's a relatively high misdiagnosis rate. We know that it takes an average of 3 general practitioners to make an onward referral. It takes an average of 2 months to actually make the diagnosis. And our recent study showed that 45% of the patients who were seen by a neurologist did not get the diagnosis at the first meeting. So it's a challenging diagnosis to make. On the face of it, it seems that it should be a relatively easy diagnosis to make. The characteristic feature of this is an orthostatic headache, meta-analysis and systematic reviews show that 92% of the patients will have an orthostatic headache, whereby being in the upright position, they develop a severe headache. Lying down leads to resolution of the headache. But the challenge tends to be that the orthostatic component diminishes with time, and that is often what leads to the difficulties with the diagnosis as time goes on. We also have a scenario where about 8% of the patients either don't have a headache at all or have a non-orthostatic headache. And therein lies the challenge again. How do you make diagnosis in those patients?
Yes, absolutely. And I was interested to read that that orthostatic component, the time frame that that occurs over can be quite varied. You mentioned a sort of second half of the day headache.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So when we think in terms of the presentations of spontaneous intracranial hypertension overall, yeah, there is this orthostatic component. And traditionally, what people have thought of is the orthostatic description of orthostatic headache as a headache occurring within a few hours, generally thought of occurring within 2 to 3 hours. But we now know that, in fact, the duration of the onset can be quite prolonged. It can be even at the end of the day. Yeah? So it can be, you know, 8, 9, even 12 hours later. The critical bit, though, seems to be how quickly do we get resolution of the headache? And the emerging studies show that in the vast majority of people, the headache tends to resolve very quickly, generally within, as I said, 30 minutes. And in fact, it may be that that's a better marker of making a diagnosis of an orthostatic headache, in that, you know, rely more on the offset rather than the onset of the headache. And on this point, the other two things I just want to really draw out are that there are other presentations you can have. There is a presentation in terms of new daily persistent headache, where a patient has a persistent headache, but there's still the orthostatic component, which tends to be in the initial part of the presentation. So if you do see somebody with a new daily persistent headache, it's worth a while going back and asking about what the headache was like initially in the first few months, because that orthostatic component can be lost. And similarly, you can get thunderclap headache presenting with an orthostatic component, which in fact turns out to be new onset of spontaneous intracranial hypertension. It's one of the presentations of a CSF leak. Moving on from the orthostatic presentations, there are two other presentations one needs to be aware of. This syndrome can present also as a Valsalva maneuver headache and an exertional headache. While those are small print, it's just worth appreciating that those are also the presentations of spontaneous intracranial hypertension.
That's really clear and practical and really helpful. Thank you. What about mimics? Are there other things that present with an orthostatic syndrome or an orthostatic headache-like presentation?
Yeah, the number of mimics that one needs to be aware of. By far, the most important is postural tachycardia syndrome. So this is a syndrome in which patients have orthostatic intolerance. They generally have lightheadedness and palpitations, but this is accompanied by headaches. The phenotype is very, very similar. And in fact, it's very difficult to distinguish the orthostatic headache of postural tachycardia syndrome from an orthostatic headache of spontaneous intracranial hypertension. However, there are some useful markers that one can look into or think of when you're looking at the clinical, how to clinically distinguish them. Now, one of the things that we do find in patients who have spontaneous intracranial hypertension is that a significant majority of them have got audiovestibular symptoms. Besides vertigo, they'll often describe the hearing disturbance, and they'll often describe it as being underwater or muffled hearing. They will also describe pulsatile tinnitus. And these can be quite useful markers that they're much more likely to occur in spontaneous intracranial hypertension than they are to occur in postural tachycardia syndrome, or in fact, some of the other syndromes that I'm going to mention in a moment. So a high value question that to look for and ask about audiovestibular symptoms. And then also for the postural tachycardia syndrome, ask for the cardiorespiratory symptoms, because those tend to be predominant in postural tachycardia syndrome. The other thing that we can do in clinic that is very helpful is to do the active stent test. Have a patient lying flat for about 10 to 15 minutes, measure their blood pressure and heart rate, and then have them standing up and measure the heart rate and blood pressure at 2 minutes, 5 minutes, and 10 minutes. And by definition, postural tachycardia syndrome is diagnosed when the heart rate goes up by 30 beats per minute without a drop in the blood pressure. And that can be quite a useful way of looking for this syndrome at the bedside. Of course, the appropriate way to make the diagnosis is to do a tilt table test, which can be quite difficult to access. So one easy way to sort postural tachycardia syndrome out from spontaneous intracranial hypertension is to simply do the active stent test. Other things that come to the differential diagnosis are migraine and New Delhi persistent headache. Now, the clinical phenotype of both migraine and New Delhi persistent headache is, in fact, very similar. New Delhi persistent headache often has a presentation that is very much like migraine. The difficulty with these syndromes tends to be that very many patients have motion sensitivity. They'll often say that when they go and lie down, they feel better. And therein lies a challenge. If somebody is saying that they're better when they're lying down, then why isn't that an orthostatic headache? The things that tend to help us, though, are that very many of these patients will say there's an improvement in the headache, but only relatively marginal improvement. They feel much better lying down, but it's often only a very marginal improvement. The other thing that's really important, these two syndromes, is it's the motion sensitivity that's important rather than the posture. And very often, just lying still is what makes them feel better. And teasing that out in the history can often be quite useful. The other thing to sort of fall back on is the offset of the headache, as I said to you. In spontaneous intracranial hypotension, it tends to be quite consistent and generally quite significant. And neither of these tend to be a factor in migraine. And it's those are the things that, you know, one wants to look out for in both migraine and New Delhi persistent headache. And the final differential diagnosis to consider is cervicogenic headache. This, again, generally there's not much of a problem because it's movement of the neck rather than posture that's a critical bit. The issue tends to be that most of us tend to move the neck more so in the upright position, and there can be this difficulty in terms of making the diagnosis of orthostatic headache of spontaneous intracranial hypotension versus cervicogenic headache. But again, careful history will often tease it apart. But these are the main four syndromes to think about, of which I would emphasize that postural tachycardia syndrome is by far the most important one to get out of the way.
Thank you. That's really helpful. Indran, let's talk about the radiological findings. You say MR is your investigation of choice, but if we're thinking about this diagnosis, what are the most useful sequences to request, and how important is it that specific sequences are included? And what about contrast and spinal imaging?
Yeah. Well, thank you for the question. As Manjit touched on, the primary driver really is from the clinical perspective, and MRI assessment serves one of two purposes. The first is as confirmatory evidence of a low CSF pressure or volume state. And the way we do that really is primarily to scrutinize the imaging of the brain. And it's best done with contrast. So what we're looking for are signs of parenchymal sagging or posterior fossa sagging, dural congestion. So that usually is borne out by imaging findings of dural thickening and quite avid enhancement. And then there are other associated signs, including venous congestion. Once that's achieved, the next part really is to look at the spine. And Manjit briefly touched on this. There are three mechanisms by which CSF escapes from the intradural system. And by looking at the distribution, if present, of CSF within the epidural space in the spine, we can then work out potentially what type of leak we're dealing with. And that's quite important for treatment purposes, for prognostication, as well as to think about further management steps and risks. So in the spine, for example, if we had a ventral, longitudinally extensive CSF collection, chances are we're dealing with a type 1 leak, which is due to a ventral or dorsal rent in the dura, in the spine. If it accumulates, if there's fluid accumulation around the nerve roots, it tends to be a type 2 leak. And it, although there are caveats to this, if you don't see a collection and there are clear signs of intracranial hypotension, then it's likely that you're dealing with a CSF venous fistula.
Thank you. That's great. So spinal imaging helpful early on then. You mention in the paper that the scans are often reported as normal by non-specialist radiologists. Are there particular features we should be looking for that might not be easy to pick out? And are there ways we can help our general radiology colleagues or perhaps less experienced neuroradiology colleagues not to miss this diagnosis?
Yeah, I think that was primarily the purpose of the guidelines, to provide, you know, insight and recognition of the syndrome. I think traditionally it was poorly understood, particularly as, you know, this was not related to a secondary cause such as a lumbar puncture or surgery. So the continuous education is important, much more so as the literature is now populated with more and more papers highlighting the issue. There is a greater understanding. From the imaging perspective, certainly a good place to start is the brain imaging. So, you know, MRI is available for most places. And if there are time constraints, a pre and post contrast MRI of the brain is useful. And again, what we're primarily looking for is that disproportionate sagging of the posterior fossa, venous distension, and dural thickening. And certainly the aid of contrast actually helps to detect these things.
Manjit, coming on to first-line management, so firstly, conservative management, so bed rest and good hydration and the possibility of caffeine, which we might discuss. Just being really specific, how strict should that bed rest be? How much fluid do you tell people to drink? Do you say that they're allowed to get up and pass urine, or do they need to be using a bedpan? And is there anything else that you suggest, like abdominal binders, for example?
Thank you, Emmy. Yes, I think all of those are very reasonable suggestions and what we have included in the guideline. Now, the first question I think they'll ask though is, what is the utility of these conservative measurements? And what studies show is that approximately a quarter of the patients will have a significant improvement of their orthostatic headaches with putting these conservative measurements into place. So the thing to bear in mind is that, in fact, three quarters of the patients do not get any long-term benefit from these. And we need to be careful about how long we go on for in terms of implementing these conservative measurements before we move on to other things. And as a general rule of thumb, if you haven't had a significant improvement within 2 weeks, it's time to move on to the other treatments, which we'll cover later on. As to which of these conservative treatments to put into place, bed rest is likely to be the most useful of all the things that we've mentioned so far. Now, how strict should we with the bed rest? To a certain extent, that's determined by the patients. Patients who are severely disabled and find that they get an excruciating headache within seconds or minutes of being upright will naturally restrict themselves as much as possible. My own take on this, though, tends to be that it's reasonable for the patients to be upright when they are feeding themselves, when they need to go to the washroom, and when they have to carry the other essential activities of life. Then I do try and encourage them to be upright as much as possible. And that it's also important to bear in mind that if they're lying still all the time as well, then you're running a risk of them developing things such as deep vein thrombosis. So there's a balance there to be struck that while we do want them to rest, it shouldn't be exclusive rest with no attempts at getting up at all. And I give patients a bit of flexibility around that. The other things that you've mentioned already are good hydration is really important. And I generally tell them to drink between 2 and 2.5 liters per day. I tell them to avoid Valsalva maneuvers as much as possible and think that they can't really control their straining on the toilet. I tell them to take measures to make sure they don't become constipated. As for intravenous or oral caffeine, the evidence base we have is really limited. It's largely down to case reports. While there is evidence for the use of caffeine in postural puncture headache, we simply do not have that evidence base in spontaneous intracranial hypertension. So I think it's something that we've said that, you know, you can use, but the evidence base is lacking. And I must confess, in my own clinical practice, I hardly ever use it because my impression of it is it's not a particularly effective treatment. And the worry in all of this tends to be that if you focus too much on these conservative treatments, you're delaying treatments. And the evidence is now starting to show that if you delay putting effective treatments into place within the first 3 months, the outcomes are poorer. So there's a pressure to, by all means, put the conservative treatments into place, but get on with the treatments that really work, because if you can deliver those treatments within the first 3 months, your outcomes will be much, much better.
Yeah, thank you. And you've already been very clear that you think 2 weeks is enough time to wait, and beyond that, we should be progressing.
Absolutely.
So if people aren't better at 2 weeks, you recommend a blood patch. Indran, we start with a blind blood patch. How much blood and where do you inject? I hadn't come across before this idea of two sites. Do you inject in two sites when you do a blind blood patch?
So the practice varies. The literature suggests that when you're administering a non-targeted autologous epidural blood patch for spontaneous intracranial hypotension, anything above the 20 milliliter mark is what we're aiming for. It provides a better treatment outcome based on the literature. When they looked at the multiplicity of sites for injection versus a single site, there was no, in a multivariate analysis, there was no significant difference. So I think volume was the major predictor. In practical terms, it may be better to try and administer it in a site where you would cover mostly the thoracic and upper lumbar region. And statistically, the reason for that is that most leaks actually occur in the thoracic spine. So the ideal situation is to administer the bulk or the bulk of the volume of blood in that region. So you can take a two-point approach with a mid-lumbar or mid-thoracic two-puncture approach or a high-lumbar, low-thoracic approach. My own personal practice is to do a low thoracic, high lumbar approach. And in the majority of cases, that's usually well tolerated. And we achieve volumes in excess of 20 milliliters, but the recommended volumes are below 40 milliliters. But it's usually well tolerated beyond 20.
That's great. Thank you. And what risks do you consent the patient for?
In general, patients will experience some degree of back pain as a result of administering blood into a space that doesn't usually have blood, and it's a normal physiological response, I explain to the patients. There is a risk of rebound headaches as part of the procedure because of the sudden rise in the total volume within the intraspinal space. There is a risk of exacerbating symptoms of sciatica, because of the traversing nerve roots through the epidural space and the irritative effect of blood. And then there are other risks associated with the procedure, such as inadvertent puncture of the dura, which causes persistent CSF leaks, arachnoiditis from inadvertent administration of blood intrathecally, which we try and avoid by doing it under direct imaging guidance. Those are the major risks associated with the procedure, albeit small.
Fantastic, thank you. And presumably that it's quite important that they're reviewed sort of prior to discharge to exclude any of those complications.
Correct. So they usually have a period of convalescence on the wards after the procedure. It's variable depending on the practice in some places, but we try and retain our patients for at least 24 hours to try and monitor them and on discharge with no neurological deficits.
And my experience has been that we put them flat after the procedure and then very gradually bring their head up. Do you practice that?
So our own practice, what we tend to do is put them in a reverse trendelenburg position. And the idea behind that is we want to try and promote the transit of the instilled blood within the epidural space craniad, particularly if you're doing a low thoracic approach. If you're doing it at a two-point approach, you may opt to actually do that to maintain them flat for the duration of their recovery. So we start off with a two-hour reverse trendelenburg position, and then level them off to a flat position for the same day, and then we maintain that position overnight. For the subsequent day, the next morning, we recommend that they either maintain the flat position or sit up at a 30-degree angle, and that's to ensure that they don't strain or stress their back during that period. By the time the reverse trendelenburg position is leveled off, we anticipate that the blood has already set in and has transited to where it should have gone anyway.
Yeah. So that covers a large number of the initial population with SIH. I think you say about 64% will respond to that first blood patch, and in some cases you might repeat that. So we're down to much smaller numbers now, but you're very clear in the article that these ones we need to investigate further. So Indran, what do we do next and what imaging investigations do we use to guide our next steps?
Yeah, so we tend to embark on non-targeted blood patches because of the response rate that's been published in the guidelines. If they are refractory to that or they don't have any sustained relief, then the next step really is to try and isolate the site of CSF escape. And that's primarily done by myelography. And there are two major techniques for administering myelography. One is by CT guidance and CT assessment, and the other is by digital subtraction, which is a fluoroscopic type approach. and both serve to administer a positive contrast agent intrathecally, which then runs the risk of obviously creating a second rent in the dura. And by a means of dynamic imaging, we then try and ascertain the site of leak. Okay, so depending on our a priori suspicion, be it a type 1, type 2, or type 3 leak, the dynamic maneuvers will vary according to our suspicion.
And I think you say that the sort of choice of technique is guided as much by the radiologist's experience with interpreting those, because this is pretty specialist radiology now.
Correct. So as suggested in the guidelines, these are best consolidated in specialist centers. Just to give you an example, if we were dealing with a large ventral collection within the epidural space in the spine, then the a priori suspicion would be one of a ventral leak, a ventral rent in the dura. So what we would advocate would be a hyperfast CT or digital subtraction myelogram. So positioning would be in an incline head down prone position, puncture on the table, either on CT or on the fluoroscopic table, and then the administration of contrast in a dynamic fashion with contemporaneous imaging in order to try and capture the first egress of contrast from the intrathecal space into the epidural space. So it's all fairly specialized and fairly nuanced.
Yes. And Parag, coming to you, what are the options now? So does the imaging directly tell you whether it's better to go for a targeted blood or a fibrin patch or whether you'd go to surgery?
I think at this stage, the key here is an MDT approach. And I don't just say it for the heck of it, but it really does matter. Getting the radiologists, neurologists, and surgeons all together in the same room, following the journey, right from the beginning, actually, even at the time of the blood patches, and then discussing the images, because it all really depends on what type of leak is identified, type 1, type 2, type 3. But then you can't just fix an algorithm for each of them to say, well, this person's got a type 1, so we're just going to do this. You have to evaluate the images, weigh up not just the patient's symptoms, which the neurologist will tell me about a lot more, but the radiologist will then point out to me as to where this leak will be in terms of and what the risks will be. I'll have to assess. So, for example, I'm going to go backwards. Type 3 leaks, which is the CSF venous fistula, which essentially really isn't a leak physically, but it's an abnormal connection between a vein and a nerve sheath. For those ones, there are a range of options, not just surgery. Fibrin glue can be injected, albeit limited literature, but the two most successful ones here and very widely reported is surgery and transvenous embolization, which an interventional radiologist will perform. Both of them have good track record with safety and good outcome records as well. For example, in our surgical series, now that we've done plenty of these, technical success rates, and I define success in any treatment as technical success, whether we've stopped the leak, and then there's clinical or practical success, which means patients symptomatically getting better, which may not always be the same, technical and practical success. But really, technical success of stopping a CSF venous fistula, we can say is approaching close to 90 to 100% really in most of, not just our particular series. I mean, I'm going to go with the UCSF and other places where public literature comes from. You're looking at more than 95% rates there. And clinical success rates also kind of similarly translate. On the other hand, if you go to a type 1 leak, which is a ventral CSF leak, there surgery plays a very prominent role. Albeit, this is the one particular area where surgical intervention is of a higher risk, really. As you can just see, it's a major MDT discussion, just not a quick one saying, here's the scan, here's the leak, go sort it out.
Yes, and really the importance of having all of those expertise in the same room at the same time.
Absolutely. The number of times the scan report will sort of suggest here's a leak, and then you sit down in the MDT and speak to the radiologist. Not one, we have three radiologists who sit in the MDT at times, certainly two. They'll point out the nuances, and then you realize it's just not your standard, what you're just going to go in and do. And again, for example, levels as well. So radiology will count levels craniocaudal, meaning from C2, whereas surgeons count the levels from the bottom. And quite often there's a discrepancy. Just sitting in that MDT will avoid the problems during any treatment and also during patient counseling, because you just don't want to get a patient into a room and start talking about surgery, but you have to have an idea of what risks they're going to encounter. What's the potential collateral for the treatment?
And you say sort of very high success rates, so really worth pushing on to think about this. What does success look like? Is that complete resolution of symptoms for the majority of patients?
The timing really matters from the time of onset to the symptoms. So chronicity of symptoms, meaning obviously the guidelines also talk about the 3-month mark, but you just have to sort of start thinking the longer the patient goes on, there may be some degree of sensitization. But essentially, the point being, coming to your question, in CSF venous fistula, in our experience, technical and practical success, so clinical symptom improvement is very high in a large percentage of patients, reaching well above 80 to 90%. Ventral leaks are slightly different. Ventral leaks, again, I talk about stopping the leak on a scan, which definitely it is achievable. And again, in my particular series where I can talk about, and again, published ones as well, technical success rates for surgery exceed 90%. But improvement in symptoms doesn't always translate. So you may assume that there will be complete resolution of symptoms, but that isn't always the case. And there was a paper from the Jürgen Breck group recently, which talks about a quarter of patients with ventral leaks who've had surgery will continue to experience some degree of symptoms, which is borne out in our experience as well. And these patients, the leaks have been successfully repaired. So that's an important point. But for me, with ventral leaks, I talk about two types of success, not just practical and clinical, but one is symptoms improving, which is the SIH symptoms, which Manjeet really described very elegantly earlier. But the point being, there is a longer-term risk of siderosis in 10, 15 years. So even when we have treated the leak, even if the patient continues to have a proportion of symptoms, what we have definitely reduced significantly is their risk of developing siderosis in 10, 15 years. So regardless, there has been a invisible benefit, so to speak, of.
Yeah, and I'm glad you bring up the complications. I'm keen to come back to those because, Manjeet, you mentioned at the beginning the importance of not leaving these people with this condition and acting quickly. But I think in the paper you quote research saying as much as 60% of people with chronic leaks will develop superficial siderosis if left for long enough. And that's obviously a very concerning risk for us as neurologists, particularly thinking about diagnostic delay. How often do you see major complications from SIH and which patient groups do you normally see it in?
Yeah, so if we think in terms of the complications of SIH and which are the ones to consider, there are three main ones that we need to consider. There are the subdural connections. Subdural connections themselves are, in fact, reasonably common. Approximately 50 to 60% of the patients will have a subdural connection. Very often it's minor and doesn't cause any problems, but you can have patients who will get a subdural hematoma. It is thought that it occurs because of the traction and shearing of the bridging veins from the brain sag. The important message over here, though, is that to be careful in patients who have got subdural hematomas, and that the surgical team, and usually the surgical teams who are looking at these patients, need to be mindful of the fact that it may be a presentation of SIH. And they need to go and review the scan again and make sure that there are no features of SIH. If there are features of SIH, then what they need to be aware of is evacuation of the hematoma will not lead to an improvement because it will just bleed again. And you have to go and treat the CSF leak before you do anything further about the hematoma. And in fact, very often, you don't even need to treat the hematoma in the vast majority of patients, because by just treating the CSF leak, there can be resolution, gradual resolution of the hematoma. Though, of course, if there is significant mass effect, then you do have to think of the evacuation as well, but it has to be done at the same time as treating the CSF leak. The second presentation that we tend to see is a cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, which most likely results from venous stasis caused by the venous engorgement, and I suspect turbulent flow from traction on the venous structures. This is reported to occur in about 1% of the patients who present with SIH. As with subdural collections, the point over here is that treating the subvenous sinus thrombosis without addressing the spinal CSF leak will often not lead to an improvement. So both of them have to be addressed at the same time. Coming on to the third one, the superficial siderosis, it's a late complication of untreated SIH. Reports are those of patients who have had ventral leaks that have been left untreated. Classical kind of a scenario is a patient gets a treatment or improves spontaneously, there's resolution of the orthostatic headache, but the CSF leak is still present. So you can have an asymptomatic presentation of a CSF leak. Historically, very often when patients improve clinically, there wasn't a follow-up scan done to make sure that there's radiological resolution as well. And what has happened is those people who present years down the line. So if you look at the data in terms of when these patients present, after 4 years, about 5% have developed siderosis, superficial siderosis. That figure goes up to 10% at 8 years, 33% at 12 years, and 58% at 16 years. So the message over here is that I think even when you have clinical resolution of the symptoms, you have to go back and check that you also have radiological resolution. There are cases where patients do not want the treatment put into place. So what we are doing in a patient like that is to monitor them either once a year or once every 2 years, making sure we're doing the appropriate sequences to look out for the siderosis. And any indication that the superficial siderosis kicks in, we will want to be quite aggressive in terms of getting on with the treatments.
And Indran, what's the timings that you usually recommend sort of post-treatment for follow-up imaging?
So we tend to actually do first follow-up MRI at about 3 months post-treatment. So I think that's ubiquitous, regardless of whether it's targeted or non-targeted treatments, and that includes surgery as well. So Parag, you'll correct me if I'm mistaken. 3 months seems to be the first time point, and then potentially a year on from treatment if they remain refractory to the symptoms.
Fantastic. Parag, would you agree with that?
I think spinal imaging, certainly 3 months earlier than that, you will see a whole load of mixed pictures, which may sort of result as a result of the surgery versus, so you can't really comment whether there is a bit of an ongoing leak. These are blood products. But the only scenario where actually we'll repeat imaging a bit faster, not spinal imaging, but sort of cranial imaging, is if the patient has a sizable subdural. Again, there isn't a hard and fixed date for it, but if I'm doing a CSF venous fistula or surgery in a patient who's got bilateral subdurals, which are causing mass effect, I certainly will scan them around 2 weeks after surgery. And so just to see there is some sort of early resolution, although complete resolution can, again, in these patients take 6 to 12 weeks for the subdurals, that is.
I'm just going to highlight to listeners figure 5, which takes you through the suggested management algorithm, which is from the recent multidisciplinary consensus guidelines. It's a really great point of reference, another PDF to stick on your desktop or an image to stick on your PIM board. Rather than go through that in detail, I was just going to ask Manjit to just be really clear on which patients you think we should be concerned about in district generals or even small neurology centres, and who you think should be referred to specialist centres and the urgency of that referral.
Given that this is a highly disabling syndrome, but a treatable syndrome, and given that we know that outcomes are poor if patients have been left untreated for more than 3 months, we have recommended that patients in the main should be seen within 2 to 4 weeks. Within the neurology centers, the exception being those patients who have the complications of SIH who are deteriorating rapidly, patients who may have a subdural connection or subvenous sinus thrombosis, they clearly need to be referred on urgently. We've also suggested that patients who are not able to self-care are probably also best off being referred directly to the emergency department so that they can get appropriate care relatively quickly. In terms of what I would ask my colleagues to think about is, firstly, in terms of the diagnosis, we know that we have a misdiagnosis rate. And familiarize yourself in terms of the presentations. What are the various presentations we have, bearing in mind that the vast majority have an orthostatic headache, but also be familiar with the audiovestibular symptoms that a lot of patients will describe, because those can be high-value questions. Be aware of what the radiological findings are like. And within the framework of a general neurology practice, Once the diagnosis is established clinically and radiologically, it is very reasonable for the general neurology team to request the first-line treatments. While we've mentioned the conservative treatments, the caveat here would be that, you know, don't prolong that. While you're asking the patient to implement conservative treatments, start making arrangements for the first blood batch to be performed. Try and perform a first blood patch as soon as possible. It's reasonable to follow that up with a second blood patch 2 to 4 weeks later. At that stage, if there hasn't been resolution of the symptoms, I think all of these patients should then be referred on to a multidisciplinary team where you have neurologists, neurosurgeons, neuroradiologists, and anesthetists working together to look after this group of patients, because that's where the complexity really comes in and where the nuances are really important. And the multidisciplinary team then should run with it from that point onwards. There's one other group that I just want to emphasize. There are these group of patients who have a very clear-cut history of an orthostatic headache, but their imaging is normal. We do know that 20% of the patients with a CSF leak can have normal neuroimaging. But there's a challenge over here because some of these patients may have other syndromes such as postural tachycardia syndrome. I would beseech my colleagues to look carefully for those syndromes. But if you still think that there's suspicion of a CSF leak, then those patients should also be referred on to the multidisciplinary team sooner rather than later.
Thank you all so much. That's been such a comprehensive discussion of a really important condition, and I know it will be incredibly useful to our listeners. Listeners, do download the paper, have the management algorithm for reference, but also take some time to go through this wonderful review in a bit more detail than we've had time for today. Just another quick reminder to have a listen to our other two fantastic podcasts linked to each edition of Practical Neurology. And if you've got time to leave us a review or tell us what you think we could do to improve these podcasts, we'd love to hear from you. That's all for today. Thanks for listening. And thanks again to our exceptional interviewees, Professor Manjit Matharu, Dr. Indran Devanyanam, and Mr. Parag Sayal.